Most of you know that I have a deep love for the work of Flannery O'Connor. Many of you have read her, some at my suggestion, many to their own dismay. She is a difficult read, no doubt, because her stories don't have your typical happy ending. A lot of horrible things happen to her characters, or maybe, as her aunt put it, is the best way to describe it. Her story ends, but no one ever gets married. It's almost impossible, one author writes, to read O'Connor without revulsion. So frequent are the deaths, so maniacal the characters, so uninviting the fictional world. There we encounter, for example, a club-footed delinquent who lies and steals because he says he's good at it. A little rich boy who drowns himself in search of the salvation his parents hold in contempt. A baptizing backwoods prophet who has spent time in an insane asylum and who has deafened his own nephew with a shotgun blast. A failed white liberal writer who contracts a lifelong disease while seeking to celebrate a secular communion with black dairy farm workers. A mass-murdering misfit who undoes a complacent grandmother while complaining that Jesus has thrown everything off balance, and a self-satisfied farm wife who thanks Jesus daily for making her both white and prosperous until she's slugged in the head with a psychology textbook thrown by a Wellesley student. But the question is, why? Why does she do this? Why are her stories this way? Does she simply kind of have this morbid fascination with the grotesque? Well, to her, her stories were not grotesque at all. Instead, she viewed them as simply shining sunlight on her own times so folks could see what they looked like, maybe for the first time in the light of day. She writes, even though the writer who produces grotesque fiction may not consider his characters any more freakish than ordinary fallen man usually is, his audience is going to. And it's going to ask him, or often tell him, why he has chosen to bring such maimed souls alive. Whenever I'm asked why Southern writers particularly have a penchant for writing about freaks, I say it's because we are all still able to recognize one. To be able to recognize a freak, you have to have some conception of the whole man. And in the South, the general conception of man is still, in the main, theological. The Southerner, who isn't convinced of it, is very much afraid that he may have been formed in the image and likeness of God. Ghosts can be fierce and instructive. They cast strange shadows, particularly in our literature. She goes on to write, I hate to think that in 20 years, Southern writers, too, may be writing about men in gray flannel suits and may have lost their ability to see that these gentlemen are even greater freaks than what I'm writing about even now. You see, the novelist, she says, with Christian concerns, will find in modern life distortions which are repugnant to him. And his problem will be to make these appear as distortions to an audience which is used to seeing them as perfectly natural. He may well be forced to take ever more violent means to get his vision across to such a hostile audience. When you can assume that your audience holds the same beliefs as you do, you can relax a little. Use normal ways of talking about it. When you have to assume that he does not, then you have to make your vision apparent by shock. To the hard of hearing, you shout. And for the almost blind, you draw large and startling figures. And she knows this. And O'Connor wittingly consoled her readers that while a lot of folks may get killed in her fiction, nobody gets hurt. And what she means by that is because she's seeking their redemption in the long run. What does it profit a man to gain the whole world but to lose his own soul? Well, she learned that kind of approach, this writing out or drawing out the picture of the distorted or what appears to be freakish or grotesque or that which is startling to the reader, in order to wake them up. She learned that from the Bible itself. And today we come to what many consider the most horrific story in all of Scripture, one that shocks us, repulses us, outrages us, and rightly so. But Lord willing, it will also awaken us to save us from a fate worse than a grisly death. And so with that this morning, let us look at Judges 19. And the first thing I want us to see is a journey into the darkness. A journey really that begins on account of a marriage. We have an unfaithful wife and a careless husband. Our story centers around these two characters, a Levite who has married himself to a concubine. A concubine is simply a second wife or a lesser wife, often used merely either to give your first wife a child or just for sexual indulgence. And so it should strike us odd that a Levite, a priest in the house of the Lord, has garnered to himself a second spouse. And their story leads from his home in Ephraim to Bethlehem and back again. And their journey will slow down and show us two scenes of hospitality. And between those two scenes, there'll be a slight pause where a conversation will take place about where one should stay in the dangers of night. Well, it begins with this unfaithful pair. We're first introduced to the Levite, who we've already said has a concubine as a wife. And we're put on guard that maybe this guy isn't the most noble of characters. He's a wandering Levite already. And now what we hear first about his second wife is that she has been unfaithful to him. And because she's been unfaithful, she's departed to her father's house. We're given no details as to why that happened. But she has played, in the text, the language of the text, the harlot. And so she's gone home to dad. And finally, after some 4 months' time, this Levite husband decides that he wants to go get his wife, most likely to satisfy his own physical desires. And so he goes to her father, and her father treats him very well. There's this scene of hospitality, so outlandish it's almost overdone. We are told that after 3 nights, the Levite rises early in the morning to leave, but he's quickly coaxed out of departing when he's offered food and drink, and they spend the day making merry, and then the night has fallen again, so he remains once more. And on the 5th day, we are told, he rises, and again he's coaxed to stay and to eat. And finally, settling over that scene, we see that the night is falling, and the host says once again, "Why don't you stay? It's not safe to journey at night." But the Levite refuses and says he must be on his way. The author wants us to know several things. It's already late in the day. He's postponed his journey. And any good Israelite with Google Maps would know that he lives too far away to make it home in a one-night walk. And so he will be forced to stay somewhere away from home prior to reaching his destination. Now, to you and I, that may not seem like much, but think of a world where there are no hotels. There's no electricity to take away the darkness of night. There's no phone to call ahead and to make preparations. You are heading literally into the darkness. And that's what we're told in the text, that it has grown dark, and it is foreboding indeed. And it is here that we get this strange pause in the story. We have two scenes of hospitality. In the middle, we have one short conversation. And the conversation simply is about where they should stay. It's between the Levite and his male servant. And it says the day was nearly over. They're near Jerusalem, which at this time is overrun with Jebusites. And the servant suggests, "Why don't we pull in here as it's getting dark?" And the Levite says, "No, I will not stay with foreign people. We will go to the people of God." And so they pass the near location and end up, we see, in Gibeah as darkness is enveloping over the scene. And again, we are told that it's dark and it should be ominous to us. The sun has gone down. And so we have these two unfaithful people in the text. And then we have, strangely, inhospitable Israel. There he is in the town square of Gibeah with his donkey loaded down with goods, it appears. And he's sitting and no one is coming to offer him hospitality. In fact, we're told that it is a stranger to the land of Gibeah, someone from Ephraim, the same hometown as the Levite, who finally sees him in the square and says, "You've got to come home with me. I can take care of you. I can feed you." And he pleads with him, "Just don't stay overnight in the town square." Something at least should be getting our attention. Here is an Israelite, a Levite in Israel, being offered nowhere to stay in the darkness of night until someone comes and warns him that he shouldn't sleep outside in the town square. As they're in the home of this host, we have what seems like a final and good conclusion to the story. Darkness has settled over the scene. We're concerned about the Levite. We're wondering what will happen next. But here he is sitting at table with his host. It says they are eating and drinking and making merry. Exactly what you would want in good hospitality. Until, of course, we see there's a knock on the door. That just like darkness has descended on the scene, it says the men of the city has descended upon this man's house and have surrounded it. And they're pounding on the door, saying to the host, send out your visitor that we may have sexual relations with him. And the host, oddly, offers his own daughter, but also oddly offers the concubine without asking, the wife of the Levite, to the crowd, says, no, take them instead and do whatever is right in your eyes with them. Whatever seems right in your own eyes, do as you wish. The men wouldn't listen. And while the story hides the character in its telling, it says, he seized the concubine and he threw her out to them. We think it's the host who's doing, but we find it's the Levite that has taken his own concubine, forced her out the door, and given her to the men of the city. And they do what seems right to them. In three graphic verbs, it says they knew her, they abused her, and they discarded her. All night long until the sun rose. You'll notice they treated her like property, like a thing, and not like a person. It says all night until morning. I mean, what a horrible fate. What a dark night for this particular young woman. But what a dark day in Israel. The story should sound familiar. And you've heard it before elsewhere in the Bible. And it has all of the repetitions of the story of Sodom and Gomorrah, where strangers come and sit in the town square. They are warned by a citizen of the city, this time Lot, you can't stay out here. This is not safe for you. You've got to come home with me. And once in the house, you'll notice the men of the city approach Lot and demand that the strangers be sent out, that they may have relations with them. And instead, over the protestations of the host, two women are offered instead. You see, we are struck with the ugly irony of the story. They have turned aside from Jebus in order that they could go to the land of Israel where God's people were so they would be safe for the night. And what they got instead was Israel that looks a lot like Sodom. When the sun rises on Israel, a revelation is made, and what a revelation it is. Notice she has crawled back to the house, too weak to enter, too worn to cry out, her hands literally clutching the threshold of the door. And juxtaposed with this, we have her sleeping husband waking up from his rest, walking outside ready to go, when he notices her there and simply says, get up, it's time to go. When she doesn't respond, he throws her on his donkey. And with this new day, it's interesting, we get new names for both characters, the woman and the Levite. Up until this point, she has been called a young girl, and now her name speaks of an older, or more matured woman. She has been changed through this event. But he, who has been called her husband, now is called her master, because he doesn't treat her, you'll notice, like a wife, but like a thing. And if all that wasn't bad enough, when he gets home, we are told he dismembers her. We hope she has died, though the author intentionally doesn't tell us whether the dismemberment started before or after her actual passing. Either way, she is treated like an animal, for the cutting here, it says he cut her to the bone, is only used of animal sacrifice everywhere else in the Old Testament. She's divided into 12 parts, one part being sent to each of the 12 tribes. I mean, what a horrific story. And it's intended to be. I mean, it's meant to shock us. And we do see that it shocks Israel. They see the truth, if you will, in large and startling figures. And what they see is damning. So the next thing I want us to see is a journey into judgment. You'll notice they are called to consider this tragedy at the end of the story. As they receive the piece of her flesh, They are told to think about it and to remember and to be there, called to action. And so they assemble. It says all of Israel assembles as one man and they call one another forward for war. But what is fascinating is that the term that is used for war here is the term that's used for what Israel was supposed to be doing to the nations in the promised land. It's the term harem or harem warfare or putting the nations under the ban. When they came into the promised land, they were to commit harem warfare over against all the idol worshiping nations in order that the land would be purified. Idol worshippers would be removed and the Holy Land would be full of holy people. And now the whole nation of Israel has been called together to purge one of the tribes of Israel under the same ban that the pagan nations were under when they entered the promised land. The reason or the revelation is this. Harem warfare is to be used against one of the 12 tribes. Why? Because their stench from sin is as horrific as the nations. In fact, worse. I mean, what are we to make of this? I mean, we find, if you will, the point of the story here, and it's a tragic one. Israel is seeing as they receive this package, a revelation, not like unlike Nathan to David, that they are the man, if you will. Israel is ready to commit harem warfare because of this particular travesty that has taken place within their borders. But you'll notice Israel was not ready to do that sort of thing one chapter ago when their priests and tribes were setting up idol worship right in the midst of the promised land. The reason God had called them to this sort of warfare against the nations was because of idolatry. When Israel saw idolatry, they didn't lift a finger. But now, because of a rape and a death, they are finally willing to act. Idolatry had simply been tolerated. That wasn't always the case when they had entered the land. This wasn't always how it was in Israel. You'll remember that once they had seen idol worship going down under the leadership of Moses, when they had come among the Moabites, and Moses had called for action to, you know, destroy all those who had worshipped the Baals. And when the people of God were weeping after that event before the tabernacle, you'll remember an Israelite showed up with a Midian girlfriend. He had taken to himself a foreign wife, and Moses can't believe his eyes. He calls for action, and one priest stands up, Phinehas, and takes his spear, goes to their home, and while they are performing, if you will, their conjugal rites, he stabs them both through, killing them on the spot. Because that sort of idolatry was intolerable among the holy people in the holy space. Phinehas, Aaron's grandson, a man from the land of Gibeah, interestingly enough. A man who is still alive in chapter 20 of this text, which tells us something. Phinehas still exists in Israel. And the reason this is important is because it shows us that Judges is not written sequentially, that it's framed, the story is told in a particular way. You'll remember we've learned all about the major and minor judges in the middle, but the story started with two introductions. And the story is going to end with two conclusions. The first is a Levite idol worshiper, and now there's a Levite who's taken a concubine. And the author is not concerned about time sequence. He wants to show you something by the way that he's told the story about why he's doing what he's doing. It means that these sort of actions that we're seeing here in Living Color were taking place during the reign of the judges. They're taking place while Phinehas is alive. He will be in chapter 20, verse 28, calling for God to come help them in this war. See, what is happening to this woman, or what has happened to this woman, isn't merely about her. She's being used, unnamed, to speak to the whole nation. This event is now being broadcast, both really, as she's being sent to all the nations, but in this writing, to warn the nation about who they are. Maybe you'll remember there was a marriage that was first presented in this book. When God is introducing the story of the judges, in that opening introduction, he introduced a couple, Othniel, who fought and won a war against idol worshippers in order to secure for himself a wife. And that wife went and asked her father for wells in order that their land would be prosperous and well watered. And they are set up as an ideal couple in Israel. He fights against idolatry. She prospers the household in her faithfulness to her husband. Well, over against that, we have a concluding couple, the Levite and his concubine. Who are they? Well, she's a second wife used for his purposes. And even in that, she is an unfaithful wife. She has committed adultery. She's treated horribly from beginning to end. And her husband ends with a different name. He begins with the name husband. He ends with the name, and I told you earlier, the name was master. But what's fascinating in the Hebrew text is it's not master, it's plural. He's called masters in the plural, which is a very strange thing since he's a singular human being. Well, why is the Lord doing that? Why is it written this way? This lady has been used and abused, left for dead, and then divided in 12 pieces. This has happened, or it's been written this way, because she's a picture of Israel. She is what they are. Israel has been unfaithful. She's an adulterous wife. And now, instead of being married to a husband who would love her, she has been married not to one husband, but to many masters. The whole book of Judges is Israel constantly prostituting herself to a new God and a new husband, one where she will find satisfaction. And because she keeps prostituting herself to different husbands, she's being used and abused until finally, even in this text, she will be divided. One of the tribes will be nearly brought to extinction in this text. And God has written the story so that Israel might be shocked by it, but realize it's not just about this woman. This is who they are as well. And if they continue in this way, they will be nothing less than abused by their gods and ultimately divided and left for dead. Israel went from weeping and watching Phinehas spear down idolaters to living in idolatry in their own midst with their own priests without a care and without anyone lifting a finger. Only outraged by this particular action. But the story is written in order that they might see how blind they've become. They don't even know how ugly their life has become in their midst because it's become so normal in Israel. Everyone in Israel does what is right in their own eyes. Now notice, what did the man say? Take these women and do what is right in your eyes to them. And the reason that language is used is in order that they might see that all of Israel has been doing that, just doing whatever is right to them. And it may not have come to this sort of gross end, but in God's sight, the stench of their rebellion and their unfaithfulness has been drastic and tragic. This story is placed here to draw large and startling figures before the face of God's people. It begins with an unfaithful wife. It ends with ruthless, uncaring masters disregarding the well-being of those under their care. An abused and divided bride. And Israel then is in holy war against itself because it has become as vile as Sodom itself. I mean, this is what sin does, unfortunately. Sin is a terrible lover. It's a horrible God to serve. It only kills. It is killing while we do it. It is its own punishment. And when it's all over, it brings a judgment. And we're too blind to see it. It doesn't matter what we're plagued with. We can't at times see the sinfulness of sin and the destructive tendency there is. It becomes so normalized that the consequences even become normalized and we don't realize how abused we've been by this particular lover. I mean, families divided all over our nation, and not outside of the church, inside of the church. I mean, divorce rampant, you know, not getting along with your loved ones as just kind of a social norm, something to almost be joked about, as if that is the way that life was just intended to be. You know, disregard for all manner of authority, not again just out in the world, but within the church as well. our depression and our selfishness, our material greed and our hoarding, all of these things have just become so normal that it takes something shocking at times to wake us up. Because sin, you'll see, comes with its own judgments. And we are too blind to even see that they're judgments until it's far too late. This story is intended to open your eyes. Particular film that came out in the 90s, without going into details because it's always dangerous as a pastor, had this particular point at its core. Even opening in its opening scene, showing forth the verses from Exodus that he will visit the sins of the fathers upon the children. And then there's all of these seemingly separate stories of families, you know, one where a father has sexually abused his own daughter, and now they don't talk at all, and she's in all manner of illicit relationships. One, you know, where a man is seeking, you know, the love of a father, and therefore is seeking physical conquest, and seemingly successful by, you know, seeing physical conquest of women and riches. But as you watch it, you see the immorality of their life, you see the emptiness of their lives, and the point that the screenwriter is trying to make is, these things that they're living are part of the judgment of sin. We keep waiting for a judgment sometime in the future, but the judgment is all around us. Paul says the way that God judges sinners is what? He gives them over to their sin as a judgment. And we have become so used to what sin looks like that we don't even see when it's killing us. It's like the woman who's abused by an abusive lover, and she keeps going back, and everyone around her can see what it's doing. And yet somehow sin and its deceitfulness does not allow us to see how gross it's become and how manipulated we are by it. And this is what has happened to Israel, too blind to see that sin is destroying it. See, the sinfulness of sin is that there is no payoff. Israel wanted particular sins and God gave them those sins. And now this is the result of it all. There's no more restraint. No one stepping in. They have been set free. And this is what freedom looks like from a husband who does not love his wife. Well, if that's a journey into judgment, I want us to close then with a journey home. We have a wife in this text, unloved, uncared for, ignored, treated harshly, perversely. We learn that the wife was not just a wife. She was indeed that, but she was also a picture for us of the nation itself. Which means for Israel, all the while she had an offer. She had an offer from the God who began this book, an offer of real care, an offer from God that if she would come to him, that he would remedy her ills. An offer that if they would do what was right in his eyes, they would prosper in the land and be well cared for. But over and over again, they've chosen other husbands who have discarded them. Over and over, she decided she would have no king, but just do what was right in her own eyes. But God doesn't just offer that to Israel time and again in this book. He steps outside of the story. He enters into the history of this people. And he becomes for them a savior. And if you're in this story, what we see here, you know, as you close at the, you know, the morning comes, there's this woman dead at the door and this husband carelessly and callously just walking over her, ready to leave. When the moment of threat had come, he sends her out in order that he might save his own skin. But the story of the Bible shows us a husband who steps outside, closes the door, and takes the abuse, knowing full well that the wife inside that he's protecting is unfaithful. He turns to his bride and says to her not only that she will live, but that she is beautiful and pure. I mean, the horror of night and the fear that is there in this text, when the sun rises, only reveals death and shame and judgment on Israel. But thanks be to God that the horror of the night that is the cross when the sun rises there, leads to resurrection and endless life. We have a God who so loves that he does not send out his bride to be destroyed, even in her faithlessness, but instead sends himself forth to be abused, to have his garments divided, left for dead in the tomb, in order to secure for himself a bride that, though faithless, though leaving time and again in unfaithfulness, though this is his bride, even in this text, though choosing time and again an abuser over a God who loves her, that he views her as the most beautiful girl in the room, pure as could be, honored and dignified, noble and worthy. As we come to this table, we come surely after a fairly difficult Bible story, not usually in folks' top 10. And yet, it really does show forth a profound reality, and that is who Christ is for us. That all that we see taking place in that text, surely what is owed to Israel in that text, is judgment. I mean, it's coming. It's coming for the tribes that performed the actions. The words that are used of it are a judgment. I mean, judgment is due to sinners. And we see, obviously, a neglected bride, one left for dead and abused in the process. And what we get in the gospel is a God who takes our judgment on himself. A God who takes the judgment of people who commit atrocious actions and bears them in his own body in order that they might be set free. But we don't get a God who just forgives our sins, but a God who cares for us, like a true husband is to care for a wife. And the Bible tells us that the husband is to love his wife and to nourish her like Christ loved the church. He said, because no one ever hated his own body, but cares for it and nourishes it, just like the Levite and the priest, the Levite priest in the text was caring for his own body the whole time, eating and drinking. He said, but a true husband cares for his wife's nourishment and her being built up. And he says, I speak of a great mystery, but I am speaking about Christ and his church. That Christ doesn't only come to remove our judgment, but to make us whole, to give us the grace needed to be made fully alive, to recover from these sins that have plagued us, to ultimately we're resurrected and made new. And part of how he nurtures us and cherishes us, part of how he comes to us, is that he feeds us himself this morning. Paul said it's a great mystery that, the husband and wife are one flesh. But he says, you know, I'm not even speaking preeminently about husband and wife. I'm speaking about Christ and his church. You are bone of his bone, flesh of his flesh. He is making you one body with himself. And he says, if you don't eat my flesh and drink my blood, you'll have no part in me. And what he gives to us in his sacrifice on the cross and even at this table is nothing less than himself, in order that we might be joined more and more to him, ever more united to him, ever more growing into who we were intended to be, being restored from all the things that plague us, both the things that we have done and the tragedies that have been done to us in the harsh realities of this life. And we long, don't we, for a resurrection, for a real clean slate, for just the ability to truly start over. Well, this table is promising that, and not just promising it. It's granting us ahead of time what will bring that reality to fruition. Christ himself and Christ in you. So may you partake of these gifts from your Savior this morning. And may you lay whatever sin you have so loved on the floor, knowing that it is only going to abuse you. But Christ comes here to restore you. And so you may receive that restoration this day. Let us pray.